yes, I didn't want to work corporate for the rest of my life, but no, I wasn't a budding entrepreneur because I wanted my own side hustle. This was a passion.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Click Collective podcast, I Started a Business, where we celebrate the journeys of e-commerce enthusiasts and entrepreneurs. I'm Lani, your host, and in each episode, we shine a spotlight on one of our members. We'll dive into their business journey, why they started, how they're going, their highs and lows, and everything in between. In this episode, we sit down with Maria Baker, the founder of Nobody's Princess, who started her business in 2020 after realizing she wasn't the only one who struggled to find snow pants that fit right and cater to all sizes. Thanks so much for joining me, Maria. Let's start off by briefly introducing yourself and your business.
So I am Maria Baker and I run Nobody's Princess. It's a business that's been going for about 3 years now, but only second year in market with product. And I'm basically catering for women who ski and snowboard with more inclusive pants for their snow activities. So be it height, size or shape, I'm really trying to make sure that everyone's covered no matter what they look like.
Yeah, amazing. How did you come up with the name Nobody's Princess?
If I was to say to most people that I came up with it, I'd be lying. It's actually my partner kind of took a thing because there's a joke about how I'm a princess, but I'm not.
Oh.
So we kind of came up with that. But it actually came from more of a chat around inclusivity in itself and niches and cliques in the snow industry, because there is a lot of that. And this idea of, you know, still deserving the best of everything, even though you necessarily didn't have all those, you know, people around you, didn't grow up in that world or, you know, start as a kid. It was just about not being excluded. So it was this idea of being a princess still, but not belonging to anyone, still getting everything you needed, having all the respect, but without any of that responsibility or need for structure around you.
Yeah, amazing. I was actually going to touch on inclusivity. While researching your brand, you do appear to be very passionate about the importance of inclusivity in the fashion industry and in general. Can you run us through why this is so important to you?
I think it sort of comes naturally, being a person whose body isn't what you'd consider normal, but really what is anymore. I suppose my upbringing, having, you know, fluctuated huge amounts of weight and being nearly 6 foot tall, I've always struggled with clothing in general, be it length or size. It really just became a self-evolving thing that just seemed naturally important to have. You know, if I was starting to hit all these pain points within the available snow gear, like, there was no point only fixing one thing, which might have been, okay, let's make it one size bigger, or let's just change the pattern of how these clothes are made just a little bit. It was more like, well, why should one person benefit and not another group, you know? And we're all unique in bodies, be it male or female. So I guess I really wanted to make sure that nobody felt the way I know I've felt so many times throughout my whole life, not just when I started going to the snow.
I love that. And have you always been a snow lover?
No, I'm a beach bum.
Oh, wow.
I'm a beach bum from Adelaide who didn't really know that Australia even had snow up until I was in my mid-20s. And after moving to Melbourne in around, I think it was 2015, so I was about 30, I met some friends and they took us up for a weekend of snowboarding as a bit of a, you should come and try this. And we're like, yeah, sure, whatever. And I bought my first snowboard the next weekend. I loved it. And for someone who hates the cold, I now seem to revolve my life around it.
That's exciting. That's fun. Have you been to the snow yet? I can see you wearing a Falls Creek jumper.
Yes, I did go last weekend for the first time.
For the first time this winter.
Correct.
Oh,
correct.
Wow. What was it like?
White and no visibility and windy. So, you know, there's still something about just not being inside. And that's probably the thing that I've taken from being a beach bum to a snow bunny, is that just being outside, being in the open air and just doing something, not being stagnant, that's really the appeal. So, yeah, regardless of the poor conditions, it was still amazing.
Yeah, I've actually never been to the snow and I'm a beach baby. So I do plan on venturing out this winter.
Who knows?
Because I've never been. And
you don't know.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I could absolutely fall in love with the snow.
Click Collective ski trip. Let's do it.
Yeah. I'm on board with that. Was it always your dream to leave the corporate world and to become an entrepreneur?
If you'd ask my family and friends, I always had ideas. Like, I was always like, let's do a cafe that does this, or what about a business that does that? I guess I've never really had anything that was passionate. You know, that's a huge part of starting a business. So for me, I loved the corporate world. I loved getting dressed up in nice clothing because that's not what I did as a kid and as a teenager. And I loved being a part of something big. I love being in big corporations and seeing the changes that I was making for, like, trickle through to, you know, the consumer or the businesses I was working for. It wasn't always my plan, but I think I always knew that I needed something a bit more because for me as a graphic designer, you know, the types of roles I was in, it got repetitive. So, you know, be it in retail where you'd be doing a new catalogue every 4 weeks, it's just the product changed, or in a, you know, more corporate business where, okay, every year there's an annual report and then there's a conference that needs assets and then there's, you know, it was the same. So I think I knew something had to give. I could definitely never see me sitting in a graphic design role for the rest of my life, as much as I actually, like, I really love it. I love it so much. I just always thought that maybe it would be another iteration, be it like sidestepping into more like marketing-based stuff or, you know, starting my own design business or just some sort of extension of graphic design. So, yeah, I wasn't always like, oh, hate that what life, got to do something new. It was more just I think I knew I could not sit still or sit in the same thing for the rest of my life.
You do have an impressive resume and dabbled in a lot of creative roles from graphic design to marketing and production, just to name a few. Do you think having this work experience helped you establish your business? And what was your previous role before starting Nobody's Princess?
So my last role before I officially stopped working full time was working at Coco Black, and I was the head of their design team there, which was really cool. I ate a lot of chocolate.
A lot of chocolate, yeah.
Ultimately, yeah, the experience I had definitely helped me in the beginning because having that experience, the marketing, the graphic design, certainly did help me in the beginning. Like my own personal mantra, even when I was a graphic designer and, say, worked freelance and helped other small businesses, was that you've got to fake it till you make it. And that means getting your branding, getting your logo, getting a website, starting your social media, because that's the world we live in. Everyone wants to make sure you exist, make sure you're real. And there's this whole thing around loyalty and trust when you're a business these days, not so much do you have the product I need. So for me to be able to do all of that myself, to do my logo, to do my branding, to build my website, start editing video and all that without any expense, without any cost, I think was a big reason I was able to get, you know, as far as I have so quickly. Because I think a lot of people are really scared to invest money in those things. And then if you can't do it yourself, you are up to thousands and thousands of dollars before you've even looked at making a product or, you know, offering your services, because no one wants to engage with you if you don't look legitimate. So, yeah, it definitely did give a heads up with that. And then the rest of it has just been one hell of a learning curve.
Yeah, I do want to know, how was the transition from working for someone else and then working on your own?
Horrific.
Yeah, so do you have to motivate yourself, like make a plan and give yourself more of a structure, or are you already quite self-motivated?
I don't think I'm self-motivated sometimes or a lot of the times. Something that I'm quite transparent about is I have ADHD, which makes things insane, but structure and motivation are two very different things for me. So trying to have some structure around, you know, tasks complete, to-do lists, all those sort of things definitely helped. And that whole period of working full-time and starting a business is, yeah, just insane. Moving here has actually been probably the final saving grace in my, like, mental state, because I leave my laptop here and I don't do work at home at nighttime. Not to say, you know, now that things have progressed a little more, I can obviously afford not to do that, but especially starting up. So when I started up the business, when I finally, you know, hit go, you know, I think it was like July 2020 or something like that, you know, put my first Instagram post up saying something's coming. I had been stood down as my job. I was working as a designer in the travel industry. So I did have a lot of free time and I was kind of pottering around, you know, during the day, because I had that time learning on webinars and, you know, some of the stuff that, like, the Victorian government puts out for, like, you know, how to do your taxes, cash flow, marketing, branding, you know, networking, all that kind of stuff. But then at the end of 2020, you know, I got bored of sitting around at home because I didn't have enough to keep me occupied with the business yet. So I did go back to working full time. So from the end of 2020 to, yeah, last September, so what's that, September 22, I was working a full-time job as well as the business. But then that's when I probably went back to work at the wrong time, because that's when things really started to ramp up at around the end of 2020, because I started looking at designs and I started engaging, you know, fashion designers to help me and looking at crowdfunding. And so it was really rough because I was working, you know, a, you know, 9-to-5 job, which is never 9-to-5. It's usually like, you know, 8:30 till 6:30, coming home and then working another 5 hours. And I remember there'd be nights, especially because I'm sort of dealing with both like a northern and southern hemisphere market, in the peaks of like my crowdfunding, I was up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I hadn't gone to bed because I was trying to engage in these potential customers, answering their questions, because I knew if I wasn't, you know, live and responding, they might lose interest and not give it a second thought. So yeah, it really was rough. And when you're in that position that you don't have the choice of having, you know, a nice stack of capital behind you and you're bootstrapping everything, that's just what you got to do. And it definitely puts strain on all aspects of your life, because you don't want to go out for dinner. You don't want to go out on the weekends. You just want to stay and get the next thing done, because there's just a million little things you've got to do. So even when I finished working full time last year, I still then freelanced 20 to 30 hours a week, which was just great for flexibility, because it meant I could choose when I was doing it. So, you know, if I got sick of stuff with Nobody's Princess, I could switch over and vice versa. So, yeah, it's horrific. It really is. And you just do what you got to do. But I think it kind of ties back into the whole, yes, I didn't want to work corporate for the rest of my life, but no, I wasn't a budding entrepreneur because I wanted my own side hustle. This was a passion. This was a passionate thing that I had experienced that had traumatized me. And then as I learned, lots of other people, and because I was so passionate about it and it had such an emotional connection for me, then I was able to give it as much as I could, because I think if you're just trying to start a business for no reason, you're not going to want to put in 6 hours after a 9-hour day. You know, it'll take years to launch rather than 12 months or something like that. So, yeah, horrific but passionate.
Yeah, definitely. I found an article by Apparel Magazine that states you raised over $12,000 via crowdfunding to build a prototype of snow pants. Are you able to talk us through your crowdfunding experience and what the purpose of it is, just for the listeners to know and learn a bit more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, I didn't have any capital. I didn't have any, you know, deposit, loan or anything like that saved up. I bootstrapped everything. And part of that was needing some funds in a way that wasn't either going to put me into debt or put, you know, my house on the line or something like that, especially in such an early stage. So I sort of turned to crowdfunding, and obviously there's two really big platforms for that out there, which is Indiegogo and Kickstarter. I met up with a person who did some business planning and kind of voiced my opinion about some Kickstarters and crowdfunding, and I kind of thought, yep, it was a good approach, and sort of broke it down into two parts. So I did do an initial crowdfunding through Indiegogo, which is a platform that lets you crowdfund regardless of whether you have a prototype or a concept or not, and also isn't as harsh as Kickstarter in that if you don't meet your target, you get nothing. With Indiegogo, you do get something. They just kind of change the fees depending on what your target is and how much of it you've received. Obviously, they want to make a cut if you don't get the full amount. And this is the thing, the crowdfunding isn't just asking for money. It's probably like the biggest marketing exercise you'd ever do for your business, in that, you know, I still had to get graphics together, imagery together. I still had to make a video explaining what my vision was, because video is king. So, you know, someone might watch a 1-minute video, but they're not going to scroll down a website for 4 minutes reading, and put all those things together to basically ask for some capital, which was going to be some marketing funds, costs to hire a technical fashion designer and get my first prototype made. So the crowdfunding is a really good platform because it A, helps you get those funds with no risk sort of thing. If you don't come through with what you're doing, people don't have to pay. But on the other side, it's a bit of free marketing because you're putting it in front of people who might not necessarily have heard about you. So it's probably one of the biggest marketing exercises that you'll do in your, you know, career of your business or in the lifespan of your business, because you have to nail it so that you can reach people that might not have necessarily heard about you before, which is great about the platform. But the other thing it gives you is that it gives you almost a risk-free feeler. So, you know, if you don't get the engagement, if you don't get the input, the donations or the contributions, as they call it, you know that your idea isn't viable. It's a way to test the waters. So I say that with a grain of salt, though, because the two different types that I did, or the two different rounds of crowdfunding I did, were for two different purposes. And because of that, they pulled different audiences. So when I did my first one through Indiegogo, again, no prototype yet, just a concept, put the idea out. And something I found is that probably 50% of what I raised in that 12 grand was actually from family and friends. You know, they, and this is something that still blows me away, is like how much family and friends will rally around you when they see you doing something that you're passionate about. So, you know, a lot of those contributions, you know, some came from my like parents and my parents-in-law. A lot of friends chipped in, you know, and it was just 50, 20 bucks here, there. But, you know, when you've got 500 Facebook friends or whatever your community or network is, it all adds up. And, you know, some people chucked in a couple of $100s and that was like mind-blowing. So, you know, something that is often done on those platforms is a gift. So you're still purchasing something, but as a thank you, as a, you know, exclusive, you know, item, as an exclusive offer, so that, you know, people can go, oh yeah, I got this t-shirt because I was one of the few people that did, you know, supported this in its infancy and stuff like that. With that, I came up with a few, you know, perks or items that people could quote unquote purchase. So, you know, they might get a t-shirt and, you know, work out my costings. All right, okay, if a t-shirt's going to cost me, you know, $10 to make, I'll, you know, sell it on the crowdfunding thing as like $50 or something. And, you know, there's the profit built into that. And a lot of people are very aware that, yes, okay, a t-shirt doesn't cost $50, you know, or whatever, but because it's attached to something and a dream, they're more willing to contribute. So after that, I was obviously successful in that, which was amazing. But then I actually did a second round of crowdfunding where I raised about 100K. and this is a bit more of the serious one. So this was through Kickstarter, where it's an all or nothing. And I mean, I could probably talk about the crowdfunding alone for like 2 hours because there's just so much to it. But again, it's a huge marketing exercise. You know, you've got to have your video that's going to appeal, that's going to hook people in. You know, you talk about TikTok videos and reels having to be viral, and you know, you got to hook them within the first 3 seconds. The same kind of goes for this, because if they watch the first 20 seconds of it and they're not interested, they're leaving. And even though it might be the perfect product or service that you're trying to raise funds for, if they're not hooked, you're going to lose them. And that one was very time consuming. There's a bit of a rule around crowdfunding that I sort of discovered, is that you've either got to have time or money. And a lot of places, in fact, most places will recommend that you have 10 to 15% of the funds that you're trying to raise set aside to do advertising and marketing for the crowdfunding exercise. So, you know, you've got to spend money to make money, sort of thing. I did not have that. So it was a lot of time. And it was, like I said, countless hours online, because I was going international, speaking to people at different hours. It was, you know, joining every Facebook community for the snow and skiers that I could find on Facebook and trying to spam them without being too spammy. It was finding Reddit threads and, you know, posting on as many subreddits as I could find. It was emailing PR people to publish an article, which is probably one of the ones you found, and just really exploiting every non-paid avenue that I could find. It's a really up and down roller coaster experience, because there's this almost pattern to raising fund, in that if you're going to be successful, you're going to raise 50% of your funds within the first 48 of hours. And that's like huge. So especially when I was asking for 100K, to see nearly 50 grand of that come in was like, whoa, within 48 hours. And then you have to watch for the next 28 days to see if you're going to get the rest.
Yeah.
And then you have this lull, and then with, you know, 36 hours, 48 hours to go, all of a sudden the rest of it comes in, because people are like, well, is this going to go ahead? Is it not? And yeah, basically used that platform though as a pre-sales platform. You know, I had pants up there for a very low price, you know, basically in different tiers going, hey, you know, first 15 people to buy will get it at this price, which is like 50% off. The next like 30 people will get it at this price, which is like 40% off, and so on and so forth. And if you buy this and this and this together, you'll get it as a bundle. And so majority of that income through Kickstarter was, you know, pre-sales, but there were still a lot of people that just contributed again and again, family and friends, people that just happened to stumble across it. And Kickstarter is a huge platform, you know, millions and millions and millions of people from all over the world go on there to search for whatever's new and great and what's being invented. And it was an insane process. But again, it basically honed in that truth that what I wanted was a viable product, that there were women that were going, holy shit, this sounds amazing, because I struggle with this too. And they were willing to put their money behind it to see it come into fruition.
How did you find crowdfunding? Did you see another business doing it? How does it work in that regard?
I'd always kind of known about Kickstarter and Indiegogo because I've seen other things that have come on there, so, or come to fruition from being on there. So it's actually really big for a lot of board games.
Okay.
So a lot of independent like game creators or artists will collaborate to make board games, and they usually do it as a way to get enough money to do mass production to then go into retail. And there's just a huge, you know, huge amount of product on there, from pet products to new innovative clothing to, you know, I've seen a really cool like table, like dinner table that came off of there. You know, there's a brand of like keyring called Orbit that started on Kickstarter. There's actually like so many products that we use now day to day that started on Kickstarter, and you wouldn't even realize if you weren't on that sort of platform if you didn't know about it already.
Yeah.
So I think it was just my own personal experience of knowing that this is a thing that made me kind of go like, yeah, okay, like let's do it. Let's try it.
I'd never heard of it until you spoke about it. It sounds really interesting though, and I would love to start my own business, so maybe I'll look into it.
It is. It's a great way to start if you've got a solid plan, if you know your concept, if you've got, you know, you do need a little bit of money to get those things like videos and, you know, graphics made and, you know, maybe a little bit of PR so that people actually go find it, then it is, because it's either going to validate, yes, the world wants this and it's a viable idea, without the risk. You're not going to have to go get a, you know, $200,000 loan to make a product that no one ends up buying, and all of a sudden you're in debt. So yeah, it is a really great way. I think the biggest thing that I would just always emphasize is it is hard, because like I said, you've either got to have time or money.
Yeah.
And you know, the money's great if you've got PR people to write articles and push them out, get Facebook ads and Google ads to point to your Kickstarter. But if not, it's a lot of time, and it has a big lead time too. You know, I probably cheated and I say like got lucky, but I did put in a lot of time for it. But, you know, I probably only put in like a 3 or 4 month lead time to that second round of Kickstarter. But most people kind of go, you know, you should be planning this like 6 to 12 months in advance, because that's the amount of lead time you want to get people to start getting eyes on it. So,
and with TikTok and Reels, how are you with that?
Horrible.
I've been in one of your TikToks though, or your Reels.
You have, yeah.
When I was modelling for one of your campaigns.
Yes. It's really
huge
hard.
Now.
I think obviously not being a Gen Z or anything myself, I'm a good old millennial. It is hard. I think the biggest thing is consistency and time. So do I have the drive to do it and some of the creativity? Yes. Do I have the time? No, that's probably where I lack. And it is hard to constantly be asking for content. Like someone who, like me, I come across as very extroverted, but I'm not actually. It's a very learnt thing. And, you know, to constantly be like, oh, hey, can I take a photo of you? Can I video you this while you're trying on your pants? Like, can I shove this camera in your face? Like, if it's me, it's fine. But at the end of the day, I've unfortunately sort of started to leave that part of the business journey where it is about me and what I'm doing, and I have to kind of switch gears about into what the product is and like how good it is and the reviews and, you know, pushing it for that, you know, that loyalty, you know, portion of the brand. You know, here's the people that love it, this is why, rather than, hey, I'm doing something, this is new, follow my journey. So that's, yeah, trying to make content around that is very hard. And I think as well, because my market is just that little bit older, they're my age and up, they're not really on TikTok. Like, yes, there are younger people that will buy, but they don't care for the fads. They don't care for the, you know, viral dances and stuff like that, which is great because I don't want to be doing them either. But, you know, a customer is a customer. You don't really care. Well, you do care, but you don't mind what age they are, where they come from. So you really have to try and cover all bases. Exactly. So that's a hard one.
That's very true, covering all bases.
Yeah.
Because obviously not everyone's on Instagram or TikTok. It's very Gen Z.
Yeah. Even remembering things like YouTube shorts are still a thing and sometimes views from there. And
Yeah. It would be hard to try and stay on top of all the social media platforms now, I'd imagine. Correct. And you would do it all yourself.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's probably the biggest neglected area I have at the moment because of the time consuming, and obviously different times of the year are busier for different reasons. So like right now I'm heavy into like designing and getting ready for next season because it is a fashion business at the end of the day too. So it's a really hard act to juggle. And even though I have the background, again, I've done so much social media in my life and created so many graphics, I can't wait to be able to hire someone to do that for me.
Yes. Yeah. That would be amazing.
I think like from the conversations I have had too, I'll add to that, is that I think there's a really big stigma about the value of someone doing your graphic design or doing your social media for you, because I think a lot of people, and myself included, get wrapped up in this whole, oh, but I can do it. But at the end of the day, we run out of time. So I think even though, yes, you can do it, unless you're outsourcing some other part of your business that's going to free up 4 or 5 hours of your day every single day so you can film, you can edit and post, then it is one of those, the biggest things that really needs to be outsourced. And whilst it has no, you know, monetary return and, you know, measurable ROI, for example, you don't post a reel and know exactly how much money you made from it, it is still one of the biggest, most important things I think someone can spend money on with their business.
Did you have someone you could lean on or ask questions when you were just starting out?
I think I asked anyone who would listen to me questions, because I am very well aware that you can't do everything yourself. You know, I don't have experience in the fashion world. I don't have experience in designing clothes. I don't have experience in running an e-com business and all those things. Early on, I think one of the best things that I did was I actually went on to an online platform called Lunch Club, which was networking, and they would just match you randomly with people in the same sort of realm in terms of, you know, was it marketing you were looking for, or finance or whatever. And, you know, this was during lockdown, so you couldn't go out and network anyway. And I've always been a big believer about that it's who you know, not what you know, and that if you don't ask, you don't get. So that's sort of like two things that I live by. So going onto this platform and doing networking 2-3 times a week with these people, I gained so much knowledge, and I think I really lent into those people. I think the first person I met was actually the guy that did the business plans, and I found that quite ironic or serendipitous, however you want to look at it. And, you know, we ended up doing some contra work for each other, which is how I got help with my business plan, and I helped him with his website and graphics for some stuff, and just making those connections, because then when you are stuck, you know, you just can go, hey, no, we haven't talked in 3 months, but I've got a really quick one for you. But the thing is, I think once you're a business owner, you don't care about that stuff. Or once you've got your own thing, you don't mind, because you know everyone else is in the same boat. And it's been the same like moving into Click. Like, I've only been here for, 4 months, and there are just so many people with different knowledge. You know, I've gone to see Emma at V and asked her a few questions on things, and I know others have come to me and asked me for bits and pieces. And it's just those little bits of like little tidbits that, you know, having that network around you is important to lean on. So yeah, starting up, I would just ask anyone and everyone I knew, you know, even if it wasn't relevant to the industry I wanted to move into, or, you know, they hadn't touched on it for a long time, I just asked everyone and anyone. So, you know, and I think not being shy to do that is probably the biggest thing you could kind of, the biggest piece of advice I could give.
And what would be your favourite part about joining Click?
It's probably the knowledge share is the one part of it, and also being around other people. And like I said, I'm not hugely, I am loud and bubbly sometimes, but I am a bit more introverted naturally. So being able to be in an environment where I'm by myself doing my work, but actually still around people is probably really nice. And I guess for me, moving in here was a bit of a milestone, you know, in that I needed more room than my garage, which was like, woohoo, you got to pay rent. Ah, you know.
Yeah.
The frozen yogurt is also cursed.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit of a mental thing from moving in here too. Like, it almost gives you that boost of the legitimacy of what you're doing. So it's almost like a bit of a fake, you know, pump up, like, okay, I'm moving into a place. Like, yeah, I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm, you know, it gives you that confidence that you're on the right track. So that's probably another perk of moving here, which is completely superficial. But, you know, I think as small business owners, and especially if you're working on your own, you need that sometimes, because unfortunately, like, as you get deeper in, you know, if your friends aren't all business owners, they're not going to get some of your trials and tribulations and, you know, celebrate the smallest of things. But then moving in here and having that, you know, like...
We do.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
celebrate the small things.
Yeah, exactly. And,
yeah.
and, you know, yeah, just almost legitimizing it, you know, what you're doing, and you have a space. And, you know, I think that's been, those sort of three things have been the biggest things I've sort of taken from being in here.
The community is definitely the best part.
Yeah, 100%.
I think it's amazing seeing different businesses come together and have conversation just regarding anything, and becoming friends as well.
Yes.
It's just really nice to see.
Yes, 100%. 100%. And the dogs.
And the dogs, yeah. Do you have a dog?
I do not. I have cats.
Oh, you have cats.
One would love it. One would love it, but I don't know how the dogs would feel.
Is are your cats very friendly or?
Extremely, extremely. Maybe one day.
You can bring your little kittens.
Maybe one day.
So, as you stated before, you grew up in South Australia.
Yep.
Why did you choose the hustle and bustle of Melbourne life?
I didn't.
It chose me.
It chose us. Yeah, my partner's work got moved to Melbourne, and it was actually quite funny. We were away on our honeymoon. We'd just got married, and basically he went back to work on the Monday after we'd got back and came home and said, hey, my contract's not being extended, but they will if we move to Melbourne. Do you want to go? And 6 weeks later, we were here. And I think in my mind, Melbourne's so vibrant and full of culture. And I think anything bigger would have scared me, you know, having not really lived anywhere else apart from small stints overseas, like for uni and stuff like that. I think, you know, Sydney just seemed like a big no-no, and still is. You know, I wouldn't have flown for that. And, you know, Brisbane was so far away, so that, you know, so for me, Melbourne was like, okay, you know, it's bigger, but it's still, you know, lots of culture, and it's only an hour away by a plane to go back to Adelaide and see my family, which is ironic because none of my, you know, intermediate family live in Adelaide anymore. They've all moved too. But, yeah, I think coming to Melbourne, yeah, it was very much a chance thing, an opportunistic thing. And, you know, if I hated it, we could always move back in 12 months. But I don't think I could ever see myself kind of moving back to Adelaide as much as I love it, because, you know, it's such a diverse town and we have everything, and we have shops that are open past 9 p.m. And,
yeah.
You know, I don't have to wait till 11 on a Sunday to go get my groceries. Those things are pretty important.
You live closer to the city.
Yeah. And I suppose I've been lucky, because I don't think that if I had moved here, I would be where I am now. I wouldn't have started going to the snow. I wouldn't have ripped all my pants and realized there was a problem, and therefore started a business.
For other people who are listening and want to start a business, what were your initial steps for getting started?
Probably like some of the more generic answers would be about like learning about cash flow and tax, and, you know, registering for GST if you need to, and all that monetary side of thing. I think getting a business plan in, even if you're really early stage, is really good. Utilising a lot of those like resources that are online from all the government organisations and Startup Vic and all that. They're probably definitely important, but I think, and it's, you know, not even what you asked me really, but if I was going to share what was really important, I think it's always about having that passion for something, because if you're not starting a business for something you're passionate about and you're just starting a business to make money, like, don't get me wrong, it does work for a lot of people if they've got the right know-how, but yeah, I think you're just going to go a lot further and be a lot more motivated to find out all those things that you need if you are passionate about it and you've got an emotional connection to what you're doing. You know, having a niche is important, and researching that is even more important than launching the business itself. I know I did a lot of research when I started with my idea, because even though I knew I needed it and I knew my friends were complaining about their gear, I still had to do the research. You know, I still had to put out surveys and flog them to any, you know, Facebook group that would, you know, post it for me to get answers, and research what my competitors were doing and, you know, what they already had in market, and if they had something similar, why wasn't it working? And, you know, had to research my demographics and, like, okay, you know, how many people in Australia, how many of those people go to the snow? How many of those people that go to the snow are female? What does that look like in North America? What does that look like in Europe? What are the different body shapes and sizes in all those different places and countries? And where do I start? So research is probably the biggest thing, because you got to go, right, what's going to make me stand out if I do pursue this from everyone else? Because, you know, there's this thing, you know, there's this term of being supernormal. They say nothing in life is new, no idea is new, but there's this thing about being supernormal. So you take something that already exists and better it, combine it, improve on it. So plenty of brands that make ski pants, plenty of brands that make plus size clothing, but obviously just still haven't hit the mark, which is great. So what I'm doing is not new. It's just a new, better way of doing it. And that all comes from research. If I was going to give one recommendation on a tool to use, podcast of How I Built This by Guy Raz has been amazing, because you learn about all these creators, all these business owners who started off in the exact same position as I have started from similar struggles because they've had something that didn't work, or they saw something that was missing, or, you know, even, you know, I listened to the one about the guy who started up sunscreen. Sunscreen is not new, but talking about how he researched it and saw what was missing on the market, where could he, you know, hit a new angle of consumers that weren't getting targeted. And so that research is probably the biggest thing, one of the biggest things about starting up as well.
Perfect. I just want to add that I have tried Maria's snow pants and they are so comfortable. They are so comfortable. Well, Maria, thank you so much for sitting down and chatting with me today. My pleasure. So much fun getting to know you and your business, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you so much. Hopefully okay. I need a bigger warehouse in 12 months' time. That's the goal.
Yes, that is the goal. Good luck.
Thank you.
Want to know more about where Maria runs her business? Click Collective is a warehousing and co-working space built around the needs of an e-commerce community. On site, we have spaces for your warehouse, office, showroom, logistics, and a photography space. So we're a one-stop shop to run your business. You can head to our website to know more at clickcollective.com.au or check out our Instagram at clickcollective.com.